From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made in a biology lab where a graduate student discovered something that would change his life, and maybe yours too. Irakli Loladze was studying zooplankton, the microscopic animals that feed on algae as they float in oceans and lakes. Well, scientists did some experiments and figured out that they could shine more light on the algae to make them grow faster, thereby increasing the zooplankton's food supply. They thought this would make the zooplankton flourish, but that's not what happened. The algae grew faster, but the zooplankton were starving. So what did happen? Well, researchers discovered that speeding up the growth of the algae led them to contain fewer nutrients, the nutrients that the zooplankton needed. So instead of nutritious algae, the zooplankton had essentially junk food. Now back to that graduate student, Irakli Loladze. He wanted to know how far this problem could reach. Could the same principle apply to plants that humans eat? The short answer, yes, but light isn't the issue. It's carbon dioxide. As plants get more CO2, they make more sugar and more starch and less essential minerals. And as we think about the rising CO2 levels in the atmosphere due to climate change, our plants could be in for some serious junk food effects. Loladze is part of a small but growing group of researchers who are worried about the effects this could have on the future of our food supply and human health. In fact, he's been sounding the alarm since the late 1990s, but no one really paid attention. That's all changing now. We're seeing predictions like this. By 2050, 150 million people could be at risk for protein deficiency. This hour, we'll talk about climate change and its potential impact on nutrition. We have a lot to cover, as you can tell, but we also have a lot of experts here in the studio to guide us today. I'd like to welcome my guests. Jane Andrews is a nutrition and labeling manager for Wegmans Food Markets. Welcome back to the program. Hi. Dr. Ted Barnett is the founder and medical director of Rochester Lifestyle Medicine, also the founder and board chair of the Rochester Lifestyle Medicine Institute, and also the co-coordinator of the Rochester Area Vegan Society. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Sue Hugh Smith is a member of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Walter Nelson is a horticulture program leader at the Cornell Cooperative Extension. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And on the phone with us today is Bob King. He's a certified crop advisor with the American Society of Agronomy and also a senior agriculture specialist in the Agriculture and Life Sciences Institute at Monroe Community College. Thanks for joining us, Professor King.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, if you are interested in the story, we'll be talking about it for the full hour, but you can also read about it in a Politico piece that I posted on my Twitter feed. You can find that at MMacMedia. It is worth the read. And I know some of our guests today, this is the first time they had heard about this issue, so maybe it's new to you as well. It was new to me. And I know the research on the subject is growing, and scientists don't really understand it as well as they hoped they would. But I'll start with you, Ted. Are the results of some of this research concerning or alarming to you? Are you skeptical of what you read in that Politico piece?
Well, I'm not skeptical at all about what I've seen in that piece. I mean, we've been talking about loss of nutrients because of farming practices for a long, long time, not just because of increasing CO2, but the way we treat our farms and the way we grow our food. What's important to me, though, is that if people are concerned about getting enough nutrients, what they really ought to be doing is eating whole plants. Because if you look at the nutritional information that, or just look at the nutrients that are available in most of what people are eating, that's the real problem. Most people are eating junk food and animal products. If you're concerned about getting enough micronutrients and not just the macronutrients, you really ought to be looking at eating whole plants. So, yeah.
Jane, I know you said that many people in the nutrition community are not familiar with some of this
research. Well, that's what the article said. Some of the top nutrition, so I didn't feel so bad.
Right.
And like Ted, I think there has been concerns about nutrient loss. If we think about food waste, that's a huge, 30-40% of nutrients lost because of food waste along the production. This concern about how we grow, for example, we know that organic production for fruits and vegetables generally does not take on as much water as a conventional. And so, yes, they are more nutrient dense, especially some of these nutrients that we have not really been measuring, polyphenols, flavanols, that we think have health benefits. So there's just a lot of questions out there about how we grow, how we care for, before it even comes into your refrigerator, and then what you do with it.
Sure.
That's what I pay a lot of attention to. How does cooking or food preservation affect nutrient loss? Mm-hmm. So a lot of different ways that we think about this.
Mm-hmm.
Sue, I know you were familiar with the piece before I sent it to you yesterday. Is this something that the People's Climate Coalition is keeping an eye on, or are these part of the discussions you're having with your group?
I don't think we've started formally discussing this particular issue, but just to put it into kind of a larger context, right? So the World Health Organization listed climate change as the number one threat to global health in the 21st century. And if you think about, you know, 100 years ago, one in three kids died before the age of five on this planet. And that was due to three things. It was due to nutrition, lack of available rich protein and other nutritional elements, air pollution, and disease outbreaks. And all of those things are threatened as our temperatures continue to rise, as we continue to allow carbon dioxide levels to elevate. In terms of the nutritional density of food, I think that's a smaller problem in the United States than it would be in places where food is hard to access already. But if we let the carbon levels rise to 600 parts per million, our problems are much greater than whether the wheat has lost 10% of protein content.
Professor King on the phone with us from MCC. My very elementary explanation of that science probably did us all a disservice. So let's go back and help us understand the science of what's happening with the rising CO2 levels and how that affects plant growth.
Well, I'm really not a climatologist or a climate science expert, but one of the things I would address when we talk about variability in edible crops, especially foodstuffs that we eat, is that we do have a history and do have a understanding that there are things that not just impact the overall quality, but also the nutritional density. And things like soil type, climate, whether it's grown in New York or whether it's Florida for that same variety, the variety types. We also get into things like water stress. And interestingly, if we remember the difference between a carbohydrate and a protein, carbohydrates are carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, and where proteins carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, it's conceivable that soil fertility would have an impact on nutrient density. So if we have things, we have potatoes, for instance, we have potatoes that are destined for chip, for potato chips, and then we have potatoes that are destined for table varieties. So if I don't have enough nitrogen, then I'm going to have a lower protein content. If I have a lot of nitrogen, I'm going to have a higher protein content. But a lot of that's going to depend on the variety, and it's also going to depend on the soil type, as well as whether or not there's adequate water and light and all that kind of stuff to be in place. So I think when we talk about things like carbon dioxide, it's not that we don't have a track record in being able to assess nutrient deficiencies or differences, not just in the soil, but the end result, the fruit that we eat or the vegetable that we're going to consume. It's that we start getting into these very specific incidents or instances in which we start looking at just carbon dioxide. That in itself, we don't have a lot of work in. It's just like the microbial activity in soils. There's a lot of things about the microbial activity in soils we know, but there's a lot more that we don't know. And so we continually evolve, we continually find new things to explore and look into. An issue is what's the value of doing that exploration and the use of that knowledge.
So do you think a piece like this is blowing the issue out of proportion? Or do you think it's fair to shine a light on it in this way at this stage?
I'm unclear as to whether it's actually, I think it's always fair for somebody to do research. An issue is what the value or the contribution that research is going to have to the overall discipline and to the overall discussion. So I think it's important that people explore these new venues, but I think it's also important for people to replicate and try to understand where that fits, because there's a lot of moving parts. So I don't know what else. Say for instance, if they were checking potatoes, I don't know what that crop was, whether that crop was what it was controlled for. If the only thing that was changed in its variability was the carbon dioxide level, what else were they controlling for, or were they just pulling potatoes off a supermarket shelf to check it? I don't mean to poo-poo that research. I think it's important that people do that research, but science moves very slow. and that's why we have the scientific method. We need to have controls. We need to have replication. We need to have scientists that we have knowledge of and can check back and forth. That's what we call peer review. And for that process to occur, it takes a while. Some of the varieties, just for instance, I was talking about potatoes. The potato varieties that we're growing today, it took 15 years for a lot of these new potato varieties to come here and be here today in today's market.
Mm-hmm. Walter Nelson, are you viewing this type of research as a doom and gloom approach to talking about climate change, or is this something that you're focusing on as a tangible item that we should really consider moving forward?
Oh, the science will tell us that, or does tell us that, you know, it is true that this elevated CO2 level is reducing some of the nutrient value, as Bob alluded to there, that with those higher CO2 levels, they're not quite as high as maybe they were in the past, but it's also in part driven to the varieties that we have today. If we could find those varieties that were in the marketplace 50 years ago, 70 years ago, and grow them today, and if we had at that time done a nutrient analysis of them, it would probably be different than the nutrient analysis that we do today, even if we had similar cultural practices, if it was only the CO2 level that was being varied. But it's in large part a role that scientists should be more aware of. The author that was pointed to in the political article is not the only one that's raising this flag or raising this point. There are a number of referee journals that refer to that. But we look at food production today, where plant breeders who are giving us the varieties for today's varieties, tomorrow varieties, the next generation's varieties, have historically been looking at trying to improve the yield, improve the quality of the product, and not looking as closely or delving as closely into this area of, what is it nutritionally? We're looking to improve the bushels per acre, the hundredweights per acre of the yield. And I think that there is an emerging science amongst many people to look at what we can do with traditional breeding practices to improve the nutritional value, that nutrient density of the crop, and it's not just of the variety that we may be developing, but how we are growing it in a way to allow that plant to do its thing to provide that value that we look for. Soil health, growing good soil, as it were, to enable us to grow good plants.
So I think for people listening to this conversation, especially if they haven't read the political piece, maybe they're wondering, how can this affect me every day? How soon might this become a threat to my health, if it is at all? And what can I do on my own to help take care of myself? Jane and Ted, I think you can speak to the nutritional side of things here. I hope you can. Jane, we'll start with you. What would you say to people?
The changes that they're talking about with this particular factor, and I was impressed by how well controlled the one study is, that they actually took seed from a seed bank that was grown 50, 70 years ago and grew it again. So, I mean, that's just one study, but it looked like over that time a very small loss, a total of maybe 6%. So, and that was very limited nutrients that were measured. So I would have to go back to something that was said earlier, and that is that we have to look at all of these factors that are changing in our diets. The major one is that we are choosing foods with less nutrition, and I'll call them ultra-refined foods. And they are often foods that have very low nutrient. And we're putting these ultra-refined foods together in different combinations. And even if it is clean label or organic, it's still starch and sugar and oil, and some people would call that junk food, but I would say that it is ultra refined and has very low nutritional value, so that we're getting plenty of calories, loads of calories, but we're not getting as much nutrition. And then that goes back to a varied diet with those basics, fruits, vegetables, beans, lean protein, all of the things that we know, nuts, seeds, all those things that are really good for us. And if you have a varied diet that's coming from a variety of different soils, because some soils are going to be high in a nutrient, let's say a chromium, a little bit's good, a lot's bad. So you want a varied diet where the food is coming from as well as the food groups that you're choosing. Hmm. Ted, what do you think?
Well, so I have to second that. I mean, in some ways it's an easy lift because most Americans are eating such a terrible diet that in order to get 6 or 8% more nutrients, which apparently is how much is missing from these, I mean, right now, I sent you this before,
yes.
About, 63% of food that we're eating now is considered processed, added fats and oils, sugars, refined grains. 25% is animal foods, and only about 6% is whole plants. So if you could take that 6%,
big gap.
Huge amount. I mean, if you look at the blue zones around the world, the places where people tend to live the longest, most of their calories are coming from whole plants, far more than 6%. We should be aiming for 80, 90, or in my case, 100%. So I also want to just address one thing about nutrient density and what that actually means, because it means different things to different people. But I think most people in the nutrition community would say that nutrient density does not have to do with protein, fats, and carbohydrates. It has to do with the micronutrients, the things that don't have calories, so vitamins, minerals, those phytonutrients, those types of things. When we're talking about nutrient density, that's what we're talking about, lots of those. And when you're talking about increasing yields, that's just weight. Right? That's just how much you're getting out of it. We're not looking at, we got enough food. We just need to be focusing on higher quality food. And one of the things that's happened is we've bred quality out of food for shelf life. Like the omega-3 fatty acids have been bred out of food because omega-3 fatty acids are not stable. So what does that mean? So anyway, complicated subject.
It is. We're talking about many different angles here,
yeah.
But I'm hoping that listeners are finding they're all coming together in one way. Professor Kang, I know we only have you on the phone for a couple more minutes, but let's talk about the long term. What do you think we need to change about our food system or the ways that we grow food in order to either try to make up for this 6 to 8% loss, if that's possible, or what do you see the future of this as?
Well, I think it's interesting, and it ultimately is consumer driven, and I think the consumer philosophy is going to have to be one of being holistic. And I appreciate what Ted and Jane are talking about as far as diet choices. The other thing is, I'm a firm believer that agriculture is an answer, and I'm very optimistic in that regard. So I think when we're tasked and asked to do things within the agricultural industry, farmers in particular, we can do what it is that needs to be done. So I think there has to be clear direction in terms of policy, and once that policy decision's made, then by all means, we need to be working with folks like U.S. Department of Agriculture. There's a lot of universities that are engaged in this, like University of Maine, Penn State, Cornell University, Cooperative Extension, good outreach. So I always look at these situations as being opportunities, and I really believe that the industry as a whole, both private sector and public sector, science, as well as farmers, and as well as the processors and marketers and retailers and consumers, we can address this situation. But we just need to have a picture of what it is that needs to be done and what we're being asked to do.
What kind of policies would you like to see? What would your recommendations be if someone came to you and said, you have the floor, what should we do?
Well, I think as it relates to greenhouse gases, I think it's one in which we ought to be doing a lot more work as it relates to agricultural production practices.
There needs to be funding for research, right? I mean, that's got to be.
And the other thing is, I think there needs to be a lot more a crossover between conventional and organics, because I think there's some solutions in organics and I think there's some solutions in conventional, and I'd like to see those two bailiwicks work more together on resolving these type of issues. I think that's pretty clear and evident in some of the recent work that's been done by USDA from folks like Michelle Cavagelli and Howard Skinner. And I would suggest people, if they want to do a search for that at USDA or on YouTube, to find that. Because I think there's a lot of positive aspects coming out of that work from USDA as well as the growers, both organic and conventional, that could really resolve these problems, if only given the chance.
Walter, what do you think?
I mean, I'll agree with Bob on that, is that if the scientists get a direction, get are posed with the question, and then turn free to figure out what is it that we have to do with those plants, in how we grow them, where we grow them, what we're growing. If we don't have the control over CO2, then we can get a workaround. Not to say that we shouldn't be addressing that as a major issue, but if your hands were tied related to being able to do anything related to CO2, scientists can figure out some ways to begin to balance that a bit.
So I know you'd probably like to jump in here.
I would love to jump in here, because I think we fundamentally have to dismiss the notion that we can allow our planet's carbon levels to rise to 600 parts per million. That would be catastrophic. That would be like changing your internal body temperature by 6 degrees. It's not like one place gets just 6 degrees warmer. And how that plays out in changing rainfall patterns and changing drought patterns would be catastrophic. In just looking at global food crops, modeling shows that a 4-degree temperature rise would devastate 35% of global corn supply. It would devastate 20-some percent of the global wheat supply. That will destabilize civilizations around the planet, and we will not be immune from those impacts. So we can't accept that as where we're going. And I think the policy for agriculture is crucial in solving the rise in carbon levels. We have to get carbon back in the soil, and organic practices, restorative agriculture is a growing area of research and has to be more broadly embraced, because that's where the carbon is going to have to go, back into the ground. And so I think it presents us with a wonderful opportunity to have co-benefits, right? We can improve the soil, we can improve nutritional value, and we can pull the carbon back out of the air. So how do we do that? Yeah, we need policy changes. And the Farm Bill, for example, is up for renegotiation, and there are listening sessions happening across our state this month, and people should get involved in that and reach out to their representatives and advocate for policies that will help farmers transition to those practices.
Listeners, you can join this conversation by calling 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also email the program at connections@WXXI.org. Or you can find me on Twitter at MMacMedia. We'll start taking your questions and comments in our second half hour, and we'll also talk to a local farmer and see what her perspective on this issue is. Professor Bob King from MCC, thank you so much for joining us on the phone today. Appreciate your perspective.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Listeners, we'll be right back with your questions and comments. More Connections is next. Coming up in our second hour, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and new data shows that reports of domestic violence in Monroe County are down for the sixth year in a row. That's good news, but those rates in Monroe County and the city of Rochester are still higher than the state average. We'll talk about how local organizations are helping victims and their families, and we'll hear survivors who share their stories. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. A lot of lively conversation happening during our break. One thing that I came across as I was doing some research for this program was there's a lot of misunderstanding, misconceptions about the impact of carbon in our atmosphere and how it affects plants. And I have a quote here from Representative Lamar Smith. He's a Republican who chairs the House Committee on Science. And he recently said, he told Politico, quote, a higher concentration of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere would aid photosynthesis, which in turn contributes to increased plant growth. This correlates to a greater volume of food production and better quality food, end quote. So after hearing from our experts today, we know that that's not true. And that raises the question of how can we have conversations that are filled with facts and evidence regarding climate change, especially at this level? And Walter, I'll turn to you, because I know these are conversations you're probably having every
well,
day.
Well, that quote is it's a half truth, because that higher CO2 level is going to increase growth.
Yes, increase growth, but the
but it doesn't necessarily. But the outcome of that faster growth is that for every ton of stuff that's being grown, we have, in a sense, the same amount of nutrient value, and that's the 6% lower that we're talking about.
Well, and it means we can grow more food in the places we can still grow food, though, which may not be very many places anymore.
That's the larger point.
Yeah. So.
Flooding, et cetera.
Yeah.
Right. Let's talk about
how much
that.
How much food can you grow in the desert?
Before I got gray hair, and before I came to Extension, I remember hearing a researcher in the 49th state that climatologically it was the capability to produce wheat for the entire United States lied in Alaska north of the 60th parallel. It's all boreal forest. Mm-hmm. But it could be done. Mm-hmm. Was it wise? Probably not. Is it wise? No. Is it being done? No. So where we grow the food, well, maybe we're not going to grow it where we grow it now. Right. Or we try and figure out what is it that's making that area non-arable, and then do something, put the carbon back in the soil, as you mentioned. Right. So that we can continue to grow where we're growing.
Well, and mm-hmm. I think you're right. The whole point is it's a half truth, right? That's not the and that's why it's so difficult, because people hear it and like, oh yeah, of course, carbon dioxide makes plants grow. That makes sense, without thinking about the broader context of that statement, without understanding that the plant may grow, you know, faster, but and have more carbohydrates, but less, you know, iron or magnesium or whatever, and thinking about how you deal with the other catastrophes that come with this more energetic atmosphere. I mean, look just at this fall, right? Puerto Rico lost 80% of their agricultural crop. What's happened to Florida and citrus, right? You can plant wheat again. You're not going to have that orange crop at the same level next year as you had it this year. There's just no way, right? So It gets very complicated with which products are we talking about. And a lot of these other products provide vital micronutrients that we really need to be healthy. And so at the end of the day, to me, obviously, this is a lens to try to help you understand that we just simply cannot allow this to happen, that you are going to give up the gains we have struggled so hard to achieve as a civilization if we allow this.
Mm-hmm. Here's a quote from a farmer named John Boyd Jr. He's a farmer in the South, and he told TheNation.com, quote, recent hurricanes like Harvey and Irma have demonstrated that we are not prepared for the effects of extreme weather events on farming. For many years on my Virginia farm, I had my corn crop in the ground by the end of March. But for a decade, my spring planting has been pushed back because of changes in the weather patterns. Nowadays, I find myself planting corn in May. To create an equitable, sustainable future for food access, we have to build a small-scale farming revolution, end quote. And joining us on the phone now is a local farmer. Ruth Blackwell is the owner of Mud Creek Farm. And Ruth, I know you probably have a lot to add to this conversation, especially regarding that particular quote from John Boyd Jr. Thanks so much for joining us. Ruth?
Can you hear me?
Oh, there we go. There you are. Hi, yes.
Hi.
Hi, I know you read the Politico article last night. What were your initial reactions to that?
Well, my first reaction was it's a very interesting article, and it sort of points to the fact that we know climate change is happening, but people aren't really thinking about the complicated, more nuanced effects it might have on us. And I feel like our country's sort of got blinders on about climate change in general. Like, they sort of want to pretend it's not happening. But the other thing that really struck me, and this has been brought up already, is that our food has been losing nutrients for a long time for a variety of reasons, and that's not talked about much either. So those are my two initial reactions to the article.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to bring in Robert in Fairport, who has a question about farming. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of discussion here about loss of nutrients, and, you know, I just think that it just sounds like a lot of scare tactics being used here. I haven't heard a peep about genetic modification. There is a lot of work being done in this area. You've got genetically modified rice that's going to be able to withstand 2 to 3 times what the carbon, what carbon is already in the atmosphere, and this is in the works. You've got genetically modified potatoes. There's one called Innate out there. There's genetically modified apples that are being bred to withstand some of these things, and I don't hear anything about it. The other thing about nutrients, too, is that when you look at a nutrient like protein, the average American is consuming almost double the amount of protein they need. We have more than enough protein.
Okay. Thanks, Robert. Let me toss that over to our panel. Ted, did you want to respond to anything that Robert had to say?
Well, sure. I mean, Robert's absolutely correct. Americans probably do get far more protein than they need. You can get all the protein you need from just eating plants. You know, I think I'd like to go back to something that Sue said earlier. I mean, the really important issues here are kind of global. I mean, yeah, 6 or 8% of nutrient loss in the plants we're eating, you can easily make up for that by eating, you know, not drinking, getting your calories from whole plants instead of from soda and processed food. but if we're going to allow the atmosphere to, you know, if we're going to somehow feel comfortable that we can breed plants and then we can withstand, you know, going from 280 parts per million of carbon dioxide before the Industrial Revolution to, we're up 400 now, and Sue thinks we may hit 600. That would be terrifying. What can people do now that would make a big difference? And interestingly enough, animal agriculture is one of the largest, if not the largest, contributor to global warming on the planet. And in addition to the actual greenhouse gases it produces, methane and CO2, it's also incredibly destructive to agricultural land. So if people want to make a change right now, they can do it overnight, and they don't have to go out and buy a new car. They don't have to change their light bulbs. They can just stop eating animals and eat whole plants.
I'm just looking at a quote from a book called Living Well Now and in the Future, Why Sustainability Matters, from Randall Kern. He's a professor at the University of Rochester. And just speaking to Ted's point about methane production and animal agriculture, Randy Kern writes, quote, a consequence closely associated with the energy intensity of meat production is that livestock currently account for about 18% of anthropogenic human-caused greenhouse gas emissions, including close to 40% of all methane and 65% of nitrous oxide. And that's a conversation that we've devoted a whole hour to on the show in the past. Mm-hmm. I believe it was the Cowspiracy show we did. Mm-hmm. So listeners, if that's something you're interested in, you can search our archive. But Robert, thank you for bringing up GMOs. Ruth, I'll turn to you. Are those conversations happening on your farm?
All the time. Yeah, no, I have a lot to say about GMOs, but one of the main things that about GMOs that has to do with this idea about losing nutrients is that there's a lot of sort of happy stories out there about what GMOs can do for you know, like there's a whole golden rice story, blah, blah, blah. The main thing that GMOs are being used for is to create plants that are not affected by heavy herbicides, right, like Roundup Ready corn. And what that creates is a crop that you can grow and then spray your field with serious herbicides or pesticides and not kill your crop but kill everything else. What that's doing is really not only putting a lot more of those herbicides and pesticides in the food, which you are eating, but it's killing all the soil microbes that are really essential in nutrient take up for your plants. So you're basically reducing the nutrients in the soil, therefore reducing the nutrients in the plant. So I don't know. GMOs, I feel like there's a lot of lobbyists out there who are telling all sorts of stories about GMOs and how they're going to save the world, but really, I don't see it.
Jane, did you want to weigh in?
Sure. I think there's, back to the previous caller, there are all kinds of solutions on both ends of this, whether you want to be a Band-Aid after the damage has been done or whether or not you want to start and help prevent. Let's go back to how we might help reduce this in the first place. And absolutely, there are all kinds of researchers. I remember hearing a researcher working on GMO corn, and this is for subsistence Africa that would handle droughts more effectively. Not GMO corn, GMO rice, and then another also working on things where you could be flooded for longer, because sometimes the rice process of being underwater is longer than what this subsistent country had hoped. So yeah, there's all that kind of things working, and I don't see why we shouldn't be using GMO technology. If we've got the technology and it'll help starving people, absolutely. Why would we not do that? But overall, shouldn't we be looking at what's putting carbon in the atmosphere in the first place? Mm-hmm. To me, this is just another line of reason. It's kind of another wake-up call. Mm-hmm. Like, what are we doing? and I'm giving you my personal opinion. Mm-hmm. I think we'll have plenty of food in Rochester, New York. I don't see that changing. But to the larger questions about what's happening to the earth, yeah, mm-hmm. maybe our kids are going to have a different issue, or our grandchildren. So let's look at the bigger picture.
Yeah, and just to, I'm not advocating that we go to 600 parts per million carbon dioxide.
I didn't mean that.
We need to get back to 350.
I don't think Sue Hugh Smith would ever advocate for.
but we're rising by 2 parts per million per year, and we have to address that, and that has to be addressed all around the world, and. We're not doing our part. We could do a lot more, a lot faster. But if you follow the rate of increase right now and assume that it stays even, which is a big assumption, there's no guarantee that we keep going at 2 parts per million. If you have some tipping points that we pass, we could jump much more rapidly. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of evidence for that in the geologic record. And so I really feel it's not being alarmist, it's just being based on science and what we know about how the Earth functions. And let's not go there. Let's act now. Let's take the preventative action so that we can improve people's quality of life right now and into the future. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Some of the, I don't know if pushback is the right word, but some of the feedback I'm seeing come in via email and on Twitter is that people are saying it's only 6 to 8% nutrient loss in the plants. It's not that much. Why are we so worried? Why are we having this conversation? But I think it goes back to what you were just saying, Sue and Jane. Unless we do something now, that number will just continue to grow. And Walter, from your perspective, oh, go ahead.
Is that, yeah, I tend to think about that, is that, why should we worry about 6 to 8% loss? Because I think that is really only the canary in the coal mine. I think that the bigger issue that, plant breeders and scientists can have a workaround for the plants to respond to this higher CO2 levels. But I think those are Band-Aids that are going on a wound that has really not been cleansed to allow it to heal itself, and that we have to look at what it's a symptom of the higher CO2 levels, that we have to put that back in the box, as it were. And in the short run, scientists will figure out a way to be able to cope with this level as it rises, because you can't turn a switch and have it start to go backwards this afternoon. But while we're figuring out how to put it back in the box, science will be able to postpone what would be a larger problem in the future.
Mm-hmm. Turning to an email now from a listener named MJ. She says, I just tuned in, but I'm curious to know how to rectify the challenges from increasing disease pressure. For example, the last 5 to 6 years, it has been a challenge to grow old-fashioned tomatoes, such as heirlooms, due to late blight, a relatively new disease to the area. The answer seems to be harder, more tasteless tomatoes that are more resistant, but maybe not more nutritious. There's several examples of new diseases in the last several years. Fresh basil also has a new mildew disease, for example. None of these existed 10 years ago. It seems to be an onslaught of new fungal issues that we need to address. With hybridization or GMO or increased fungicide, is that the only answer? Is this, this is a challenge for small farms. Ruth, I'll turn to you.
Yes. late blight is the bane of my existence. Late blight has been around forever. The thing about late blight is that it doesn't survive in the soils here over the winter. It's a fungus, and it gets too cold here for it to survive in the soil. So each year we get it as it blows up from the south on the wind. And the reason we get it earlier is because it's warmer, but also when it's really a wet year, we get it earlier than usual. And as an organic farmer, that's one of those things that I can't do much about, although if I grew my tomatoes in a hoop house, I could fend it off a little longer. But yeah, there's as the climate is changing, and every organic farmer will tell you, or any farmer really will tell you, they've been seeing changes in the weather for a while. We're definitely facing new diseases and new pests that we wouldn't necessarily see before. Most of them are like more warm season, warm climate things that are showing up here that didn't used to be here. And we just have to constantly try and keep ahead of it.
Mm-hmm. Anyone on the panel like to jump in there?
I mean, she's very right. I'm not sure that they're new diseases, but they're diseases that are showing up at other times of the year. I mean, typically we would get a late blight infection in August or early September, but with the strange storm of whatever month, whether it be June or July, I can think back just in the last decade, there was a June 14th thunderstorm that rolled through western New York that was a cell that moved up the Ohio Valley, and 3 days later, I had late blight. It came in on that storm.
It's all connected.
It is. Well, that, you know, I think Jane raised that earlier. We're not talking about prevention. We're talking about putting on Band-Aids. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems is there's really no good business model for prevention. You can make a lot of money solving problems, but you can't really make any money preventing problems. And that's, I think, a major challenge for our culture going forward. We see this in medicine all the time. There's really not really many good business models about preventing disease. There's plenty of great business models about treating the symptoms. And, you know, if you think about the elephant in the room, we have a population in our country, a significant percentage of whom don't even believe in global warming and don't believe in human-caused climate change. That, to me, is the big issue, and I have no idea how we're going to handle that. But that's something we definitely have to face, and we need to all be on board because this is going to take a lot of cooperation.
This may be too big of a question for the time we have left in the hour, but how can we change the conversations that we're having so some of these people start to understand the facts and the evidence behind climate change, Sue?
I think, for one thing, by having them, by being willing to speak about the climate impacts that are happening around us, the things that we see. Looking at some basic, articles that you can point to so that people understand that this is happening right now, that open up those avenues of conversation. And to do so in a way, there are many paths to solving this problem, right? And we say there's no economic model. And though I don't disagree with you, on the other hand, the problem is that we are putting the costs of inaction on society as a whole, right? Whereas there are ways to individually profit from things, the society is picking up this expense. And until we internalize those expenses in a way, I don't know that we'll get the rapid change, which is why there are people working on things like a carbon tax, right, that would help shift that.
I think one of the issues is, who do you trust? And how can we look at the science with clear eyes when people aren't looking at science with clear eyes? We're all advocating for our own point of view, and we know what the answer is before we look at the science. So I think, finding ways to develop trust is going to be hugely important. And at the same time, those who exaggerate, I'll give you an example in the nutrition world. I have people all the time marketing dietary supplements who say, you have to take my supplement because there's no nutrition in the food. It's gone. There's no nutrition. And that's an exaggeration in so many ways to say that there's no nutrition in the food. There's all of this is adding up, maybe, but the idea that you have to take a dietary supplement, most people listen to that nonsense and think, I'm going to ignore that. It's an exaggeration. So I think we do have to be clear-eyed and actually look at the data. That's why I like this research. It was an emerging piece of research. Right. I'd like to see a lot more validation, but to me, it's another reason to pay attention to climate change.
Mm-hmm. What I thought was so interesting about this Politico piece is when the research was, or the ideas were presented to different experts. At first, they were like, no way. I've never heard of that. I don't know if that's true. And then they read the evidence and they said, okay, I'm coming around. I want to see more. But you can see that change right in this article. Maybe that's reflective of society as a whole. Maybe I'm too
hopeful.
We're
often in our own, especially academia, somebody finds out something and they might have found it out 30 years ago, but they didn't read the research in that other area. So that's where collaboration in academia is so helpful.
And if people are looking for a good reference on this, I always look at the health2016.globalchange.gov site, and there's impacts of climate change on human health. There's a variety of chapters. Chapter 7 is actually looking at the nutrient issue. But they cite peer-reviewed work, and you can click on those citations, you can follow those citations, and read the journals that have been peer-reviewed. Mm-hmm.
We're down to our last few minutes, and I'm seeing some emails come in with recommendations about diet and nutrition. One is from Kat. She says, we can diversify our microbiomes through eating not only food from the ground, but also fermented foods like kombucha and, I'm going to butcher this, even though she provided a pronouncer, K-E-F-I-R, help me out.
Kefir,
thanks.
Kefir, yep.
Which have live microbiomes, that is bacteria and yeast. So that's from Kat.
That's all true.
Sure. So thanks for that. Go ahead, Ruth.
One of the important things to know about, you know, diversifying your diet or getting more nutrients out of your food is that, I mean, I'm going to be plugging myself shamelessly here, but if you're buying food from local farms, you're getting a lot more nutrients out of your food because it hasn't been sitting in cold storage forever. That's where you start to lose some nutrients as well. All those enzymes that are in the food originally, right when you harvest it, that help you get all the nutrients out of it, start to die. So local food is usually better for you, and organic food is too. I mean, you're dealing with a farm that's been building healthy soil for a long time. The healthier your soil is, the healthier the food is. So those are just things to think about if you're trying to get more out of your food.
Thanks, Ruth. We're down to our last 2 minutes, and I'd just like to go around the table here and on the phone. And if each of you could share your 30-second recommendation, what is your priority as far as this conversation goes? What should we be focusing on? I know that's a big question. But I have so many perspectives represented here, and I think the listeners would benefit. I certainly would from hearing different takes. So, Jane, we'll start with you. No pressure.
Oh, no pressure. I think other forms of energy are so important, the beyond fossil fuels, and certainly overall looking at what we're eating and you know, having more vegetables. I mean, I've been preaching more vegetables since Strive for Five started in 1991, and we still haven't made a huge. So we need to keep working on those ideas.
Walter?
I would say that nutritional one, before we came on, I said, you know, it's boiled down to five words, at least for us in the first world, and that's eat more fruits and vegetables. But to address your question, it's we're going to have to agree that we do have a change going on in the climate. One of the manifestations thereof is an increase in the CO2, and what are we doing about it?
Ted?
So I think we need to start thinking of the entire planet as one biologic organism. I mean, I'm the high-tech doctor with low-tech solutions, and the low-tech solution is to think about our microbiome as just part of an extension of the soil. Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
Sue, 10 seconds.
Get engaged, get involved, take some action. We got a Climate Solutions Summit coming up on October 28th if you want to explore some possibilities.
Mm-hmm. And Ruth, 5 seconds.
We need to really face the fact that it's an issue, that climate change is an issue. And I agree with the soil. Soil is the root of it all. Healthy soil.
Thank you. Thanks to all of my guests, Jane Andrews, Dr. Ted Barnett, Sue Hugh-Smith, Walter Nelson, and Ruth Blackwell. Thank you all for listening. More Connections is next.